especial de música castellana, luego en inglés para ellos. Empezamos nosotros desde la cátedra y además se nos recibió, nos cogieron muy amablemente, que a lo mejor algunos de los asistentes al seminario tendrían interés en tener alguna sesión extra. No tanto con el profesor Quay, que a él le reservamos solo para sesiones de las 2 horas largas que hace por las tardes, sino más bien con el profesor Tren, con el profesor Gibson Follestad, que son absolutos expertos, reconocidísimos, el profesor de Mora, si lo desea, son absolutos expertos en su obra, para que los que quisieran, algún día por la mañana, pudieran tener una reunión con ellos. Esto seguramente incluso facilitaría la comprensión de las sesiones de la tarde y el aprovechamiento del trabajo realmente diseñado. Oferta mía, para mañana. Para mañana por la mañana. Había, luego cuando me da hora y sitio, había algunas personas aquí presentes interesadas, no solo interesadas, sino que se pudieran comprometer, porque no vamos a reunirles a ellos para que no estén aquí, que se pudieran comprometer mañana por la mañana en alguna hora, si ya veremos cuándo, a estar presente y a participar en esta sesión de seminario. ¿Quién? Uno, dos, tres. Los aquí presentes, uno, tres. Discussion will be some points, perhaps those which have already been discussed by Professor Quine here, or just to pre-announce some future topics, as you like. When would you prefer to do this? Here in the house, of course. I will look, or it might be convenient to do it in the hotel. But in the hotel you have the blackboard. Better here. But I will look for a room, that's no problem. The time. But they are prepared, they are just ready. Very time. Aquí, ¿no? ¿Qué hora sería la preferible? But you go out by now, isn't
it? I'll
I renew the secret.
Señor Rodriguez, por suerte, no es el nombre de él.
Es aquí,
Moving to physicalism, we gave access to neurology, psychology, and the rest of science insofar as it was of any use to us in our epistemological efforts. And at that point, the quandary over protocol sentences readily resolved itself, and we settled on. It became clear that we wanted something as close as possible to the input from the external world, therefore as close as possible to sensory stimulation. The boundary between philosophy and science thus varies. In particular, the boundary between epistemology, neurology, psychology. Likewise, likewise, I am trying to blur the boundary between mathematics and natural science, even. What then would I account for, try to account for in these speculations? What would I lead, rather, to psychology and other sciences? Well, I accepted the impacts of rays, light rays and particles on extra sensors. While leaving the theory of rays and particles to the physicist, and leaving the receptors to the neurologist. The processing that leads from the triggering of the receptors to perception, the elaborate processing through the brain, to perception, I say, which is to say, to the various degrees of perceptual similarity, those processes, we are certainly happy to leave to the neurologists. And then I showed the results, global stimulations, as raw material to work from that point onward. Global stimulations and the relation between the perceptual similarity for individual subject. Because this seemed to be an adequate launching pad, supposing all these things provided, launching pad for our knowledge of the external world. The mechanisms of conditioning and learning, again, I leave to the to neurology and to psychology. In general, my policy is to leave to science leave science to the scientists as long as it makes no novel demands from our epistemological inquiry. As long as there are no demands from our special point of view of the kind that wouldn't be met as a normal demand from any other or any neutral point of view by the scientists in question. Use their explanations where they're pertinent, then organize the connections, speculate on the missing links, but assume no longer the principle between philosophy and science. So, my purpose is to analyze a relation of evidential support between stimulation and science. Science is couched in sentences. We progress from stimulation to sentences, namely observation sentences. There's the first step. However, observation sentences are occasion sentences, true on one occasion, false on another. Science proceeds rather in standing sentences which purport to be true or false, but purport in fact to be true once and for all. I picture us breaking into scientifically viable standing sentences which we figure as part of the body of science, with what I call observation categories. An example, when it snows, it's cold. This is compounded of two observation sentences, it's snowing and it's cold. It generalizes asymmetrically over the conjunction of these two observation sentences. This is the conjunction, it's snowing and it's cold, but it generalizes asymmetrically when it's snowing, it's cold is one thing, when it's cold, it's snowing is another. This variety of observation categorical, when it snows, it's cold, I call a free observation categorical. The illusion being that it does generalize in its way on a conjunction. I call it a free observation categorical in contrast with a focal observation categorical, which generalizes not on conjunction, but on an observation predication. An example of this kind of observation categorical is where there's a swan, it's white. Swan, there's one, or there's a swan, there's one observation sentence. It's white, there's white. Another observation sentence. The compound is a standing sentence, an observation categorical of the focal variety of where there's a swan. It's quite, or more briefly, swans are quite. Example notes need to be true. It's just a standing sentence, true and false. Viewed retrospectively in our full theoretical language, observation categoricals are universal quantifications, they're universal generalizations of conditionals. But at the beginning, we should see them better in language, not with the sophistication of conditional and universal quantifier. Entering language rather at the primitive edge, the child's learning edge, as more primitive than quantification, more primitive than reification, more primitive than reference. They express an incipient of habit, expectation, an incipient habit of conditional expectation. It's snowing, expect it to be cool. See it's a swan, expect it to be white. Here it is, a swan. Look and see it, it's white. They express, in other words, an incipient primitive induction. They would be affirmed with some degree of belief if the induction had already tentatively been made. Perhaps the child's first standing sentences are these, observation categoricals of one or the other kind. They express the confidence of verbals. Now, I see this as the fifth stage of a series of stages in the evolution of the language. In the beginning, there are inarticulate experiences, expectations. There are inarticulate expectations in the beginning. Inarticulate standards of similarity, similarity space. Nothing like language. Second stage, we get animal signals. The great thing about an animal signal being that it can be heard at a distance, it can be heard from a place where you can't see the object that's being announced by the creature that's doing the shouting. They enable the community to share the vicariously the perception of the one who's on watch, who's the object. Third stage, we have a simple observation sentences. This is just a continuation of the second stage, the animal signals, but we have a much more abundant supply of such simple observation sentences than any other species of animal. Then the fourth stage, we get we compound observation sentences into further observation sentences, and this perhaps is peculiarly human. The fifth is surely exclusively human, the observation categories. These five stages are not disjoint. Earlier stages continue, though the others supervene, the operations characteristic of the earlier stages continue. Further simple observation sentences are acquired, learned by extension or learned indirectly in some way or another, learned even via theoretical science, coming back down again at a sophisticated adult level. Observation sentences continue to swell their ranks. Even after we've been compounding them, even after we've been getting observation categoricals, and even after we've been getting scientific theory. Even the similarity space certainly changes with experience. But these are five stages in the sense that the emergence of each of these things is successive in that sequence, presumably. In the evolution of language, observation categoricals must have been a tremendous upturn as far as survival is concerned. Signals, in other words, observation sentences of a similar kind, signals gave us the benefit of the neighbor's present stimulation. But the observation categorical gives us the benefit of the neighbor's conditional expectation of which he's been building up in the course of his life. He's been getting it the hard way, or maybe he's acquired it by word of mouth from somebody else who got it the hard way, from continuing observation. It's the beginning of accumulated scientific lore, the observation category. It's the beginning of science. It even captures the experimental situation of science in a rudimentary way. It exhibits experiment in miniature. The first component, the process of the observation categorical, states the experimental condition, you might say, produces one. The hypothesis that gives the predicted experimental result. Free observation categorical is refuted by an observation conjunction. It's snowing, but it's not cold. That refutes that categorical when it's snowing, it's cold. A focal observation categorical is refuted by an observation predication. Here's a swan, and it's not white. An observation predication compounded of two observation sentences, the one being swan and the other being the negation of white, not white. This latter example is demo, depending on the swan that isn't white. Recalls again the point I made earlier about vagueness in observation sentences, vagueness in stimulus meanings of observation sentences. Because if this purported swan is encountered, who's not white, one might actually give up either the categorical and say, well, another was white, or give up one of the observation sentences, decide that it's not going to be treated any longer as an observation sentence, that it takes more than an observation, including the observation of the color, to identify a swan. Well, I pictured observation categoricals as a fifth stage of evolution, of this conjectural way, and the first stage of science. But I'm at a loss to sort out the next steps into science of a more serious kind, either in prehistory or even in the child's learning process. You recall that Carnap and the Alpha gave us insight into organizing objects into free space, time is more vapid still than three-dimensional space in this reification of objects and identification of them, re-identification of the principle of individuation. I pointed that out in connection with Berkeley, how much in the way of an elaborate theory of the world, theory of behavior of unseen objects between observations and the various conjectural trajectories crossing one another, however the object got from ear to ear between observations, and somehow measure that conjecture with what one's conjecturing about the other neighboring objects. Maybe the development of this quite subtle and elaborate skill will be illuminated by, one hopes, by research in psycholinguistics, neurology, child psychology. Once we're in command of that much common sense, common sense scheme of things, something that every human has, in fact, every normal human in any culture. Once we're accustomed to thinking in terms of causal regularities, which certainly drivers involved in this, then our flights, the flights of humanity into still higher theory, are much less mysterious. I think we can make much more sense of that once we have this common sense and notion of persistent recurrent objects and causal connections. Then the further flights to invisible objects, sub-microscopic objects, and abstract objects. Pretty plausible scenarios can be constructed for those step by step in terms of analogy and mainly analogy. But because of those intervening mysteries, and also in order not to let the trees obscure the forest, I'm going to lead to where scientific discourse is full-fledged and consider from here on, in outline, the net result, the net resulting connection between theory and observation in going science, at least of a relatively simple-minded, old-fashioned sort of natural history, as it's been called. A hypothesis is tested by testing an observation categorical. If you test an observation categorical that the hypothesis implies. The observation categorical, as we saw, is what dictates the experimental test. You test the hypothesis. The experimenter, once you found the categorical which is implied by the hypothesis in question, the experimenter sets up the condition of the process of the categorical in his experiment and looks for fulfillment of the hypothesis. And if it fails, we expect him to drop his hypothesis which implied the categorical. The categorical says, given that hypothesis is true, do some logical deduction, you get to this category which says if this is set up, whenever this happens, this observable thing, this is going to happen, there's a category. All right, let's make this happen once this time, see if this time that happens. Failing that, the whole thing is canceled out. At least normally or in principle. Earlier literature on posterior science, Temple, Nagel, and other, the familiar pattern that we have from them, of course, is, a little different about the form. We make an observation, maybe experimental condition. That observation, together with the hypothesis, implies another observation. Just All I'm doing really is rebuking that here, getting the observations together. Hypothesis. If the hypothesis then, now we have observation, then observation. And this subordinate conditional, appropriate to modify, is the implied observation categorical. This is the hypothesis that implied. However, usually what logically implies the observation categorical isn't just the hypothesis in isolation, and this is the familiar point which is specified up here at UN, and the back point which surely is obvious in every term, when you think about what one would do in science. It's rather in company with the rest of the theory. It's more of the point to picture it this way. The theory implies the observation category. And if the theory implies it, of course, all you're probably going to use is enough of the theory to still sense the implication. It would be a lot of the overall theory that's not relevant. But you've got you've got a little theory here, a little cluster out of the big theory, or you've got just a little cluster from the inclusive theory. If the observation categorical fails, if the experiment turns out negative, then the thing that implied it, that cluster, the theory, or the bundle of hypotheses from it, has to be questioned. And in order for it to fail, of course, it's enough that one of its components failed. Think of it as a conjunction of its components. But what are involved typically when a scientist is testing a hypothesis, he has this suspicious hypothesis which he is interested in testing, but there are also all the ones that he's not worried about, some of which he needs also in order to pinch the implication of. The hypothesis alone is going to imply this categorical, presumably. There'll be some mathematics along with it. Those are among his further auxiliary hypotheses, those mathematical laws. There'll be some platitudes that go without saying, ordinary common sense, which would have to be made explicit if we're going to clinch the implication explicitly in logical terms. And any of these things, appearances could be saved, in Plato's phrase, appearances could be saved if any of these things was discarded from the combination which only has a joint assumption, the theory, that implied that result. In practice, typically, when the scientist is testing a hypothesis, as he says, the point is that that's the only thing he's doubtful about at the time. And if the experiment turns out negative, that's the thing he's going to drop. But if he were stubborn about it, he could have gone on and maybe find another way out. And something else that he would say had gone wrong, that he dropped some other auxiliary hypothesis instead. What about the implication itself? What about possible? We internalize the elementary rules of logic in acquiring the logical particles. Someone who learns to combine even observation sentences by an or to make an alternation, which in turn is an observation sentence. If he denies that compound, but still affirming one of his components, we say, and rightly, that he's simply misusing or he hasn't learned it. If he doesn't do that, if he obeys rather the logical law that either component of ordination implies the ordination. Mastered that classical law. He's mastered it in mastering the use of the or, because that's what the mastery consists in. And the corresponding point about the and, when he's learned to use and, he has learned not to, he's learned to be disposed to assent to either component, if he is disposed to assent to the component. And then the corresponding question about not and about combinations of three, that basically being inferred then from the habits that he's already formed in the process of learning these logical particles that he's learned. So there's the mastery of the elements of logic, similar to can be said about quantifiers or the vernacular equivalent of quantifiers in ordinary language, when they do get learned. But now, logical truths, on the other hand, what I'm going to speak of as logical truths, are not laws of logic in that sense, not such laws as if a conjunction is true, each component is true, and so on, but rather, they're ordinary sentences about ordinary things, but sentences that just happen to be logically true in the sense that any sentence with that form is equally true. Set form, well, by that I mean any sentence of that logical form. That is to say, any sentence has the same logical particles in the same places and differs from the given one only in the non-logical components, the various nouns and adjectives, whatever, which are linked up by the logical science. So, logical truth. Things are pigs, logical truth. If snow is white, then snow is white, or grass is green, logical truth. If snow is white, then snow is white, and grass is green, no. Not logical, it's true, yes. We can picture as many of these logical truths as we like, along with the other platitudes, as many of these as we like that are platitudinous enough so that our science itself would assent to them if asked, if he wasn't too impatient with foolish questions. These are among the ones that go without saying, the platitudes that are there in the theory that's being tested, along with the explicit hypotheses, and along with the tacit but non-trivial auxiliary ones that he would need in the particular implication that he's drawing, possibly pure mathematics, among other things. So these would qualify, these civilizing truths would qualify among the all the ordinary platitudes, many of which aren't logical truths at all. So let's think of the science that's having some working theory, which isn't necessarily this inclusive theory of the universe, but a bigger little a chunk of truth, a fairly dark one perhaps, a theory called theta. Let's let this include all the obvious ones that our scientists would unhesitatingly assent to if asked and if patient with such questions. That would include these trivial logical truths like pigs and pigs, and a lot of non-logical ones that are equally go without saying. It wouldn't include all of them, but it would include all the short ones, all the ones that we could set to without having to do a lot of figuring. I picture it the following way: his finding that is theory phi implies a given observation, a categorical small phi theta, I mean, implies a small phi observation categorical. Well, the physicist ponders theta, various sentences in theta. He finds, among others, he finds a sentence psi. He also finds a conditional. He doesn't find chi. But having found these, and by finding them, he's finding broad enough so that one of them, this one very likely, goes without saying. He doesn't say it even to himself, but just sees it. Here's psi and there's psi and chi. So he has chi. Thus enlarging theta, adding one more sentence to it, it's theta prime. And he goes on this way, finds another, this is conditional, adds its consequent because he didn't have it there yet, either in his record or in his tongue, something that was without saying. As that, as a few seconds, and so he goes. He's growing this way, most forces each time, his first bonus, his enlargement bonus. And eventually, phi gets into it by that process, and that is the observation categorical question. And so I'm thinking of this as a scheme, just for how it is that the scientist, who's not being self-conscious about logical apparatus and deduction and right, how he finds that the observation categorical is implied by the old original theta. He's not thinking about theta growing to a theta prime, theta second, and so on, but that's the way Huygens did it. As he makes these successive usually tacit, and even sometimes unconscious, perhaps steps of inference. But it will always, as far as I can see, it will always proceed in this way. That next thing that gets added, that chi this time, is added because he sees that it follows from what was before. He said that I want to complicate the picture just one way. Instead of talking about psi, and looking at the conditional, I would like to say a number of, it finds a number, psi 1, psi 2, psi n. And then he has this conjunction. He notices this conjunction. As we have seen, and chi is consequent, it's also true, obviously true, perhaps logically true even. Sometimes those are going to be logical true, sometimes not, it doesn't matter. The elementary laws of two will be in there among the rest. And at this point, Gödel's proof of the completeness of elementary logic, the completeness of predicate logic and two functions of logic together, becomes relevant because it means that all logical inference can be carried through on the basis, finally, of the logical principles that we know, the ones that are simple enough so that even the physicists not interested in logic would recognize once the all the more complicated ones can be built up, can be derived, can be, their results can be arrived at by iterated use of the simpler ones. There's completeness. So this is a way that the unconscious use of logic, it seems to me, by the scientists can be caricatured. And then the experimental process itself, which is the end of this process, can be caricatured as the testing of an implied observation category. if the physicist fails to recognize some needed logical proof? What if this escapes him? Well, that's all right. Then he won't find, perhaps, that phi was implied by theta. No, it was. Therefore, we won't make the experiment. And we'll expect these things to happen, or fail. Well, what I'm saying is science and theory applies essentially, for example, also to our daily thought and our daily expectations. Experimental science is just an extension merely of our common sense methods. The matter that becomes somewhat more explicit. And what I'm trying to do now is make it more explicit still in a schematic way. So I'm picturing a theory of theta, or better perhaps an evolving succession of theories, theta, theta prime, theta second, and so on, as a seeding mass, moving in varying degrees from point to point in this mass of interrelated sentences. Some of it we rate as purely logical. Some of it is purely mathematically true. Some of these are there are in among the rest. And they're notable for their want of mobility, but that again is a matter of degree. Observation categoricals are there too. Ones that we believe, pending, of course, future findings, but then that's quite characteristic of a scientific truths or scientific hypotheses, scientific tendencies, if you will. Well, I say seeming. How does it seem? What's the input of energy in this that makes it seem? The input, one way, the scientist. Pursuing the inner logic, so to speak, just scanning, thinking about his theory theta, that discovers a sentence and its negation in there. And you think, well, what have we got? And you see, well, good heavens, there's also this conditional hold, this sentence here and the negation over here. But this indicated sentence, consequent of this conditional, is already also in this theory by itself. He's going to get the contradiction of psi and upsi. He's going to excise one or the other. Having excised one or the other, so here he's changing the theory. Now he's taking something out. This is not a result of the deduction followed by experimentation. This is just a matter of his studying the theory, pondering what to do next, and trouble. So he takes out one of these factors of the components of the contradiction. Then he's got to work the theory some more and make sure as best he can that there aren't some other things in there that are still going to imply the formula that he's taken out. So there could be back to contradiction again. And the theory is going to evolve further in that process. Each time his choice what to take out is important. Because although contradictions can be avoided, or in this case, eliminated by either of various excisions, one excision can be better than another in that the resulting theory will stand up better to future observation. And so that's why he wants to make the best choice. But there, I think it's hopeless to give any general rule, there are various kind of maxims that one would follow, and I'll come to those, some of them. But he uses judgment as best he can and hopes for the best. He wants the new theory to withstand further tests. Finally, he'll seek a new hypothesis to strengthen his theory, having made this excision. He wants the theory to be stronger. After all, he wants it to apply as much as he can. So then he'll pursue the consequence of adding various one or another new hypothesis until he finds an observation categorical which is new to the theory, and then he'll make an experiment. And this is a matter of just testing his new hypothesis by experiment. So that's one way in which the theory can undergo change. Another way begins again by mulling over this theory as it stands, the theory theta, but not this time finding any contradiction. Instead, the scientist gets a bad idea. He thinks of a hypothesis that's compatible with theta. It's not there, but it's more general. So that it will both simplify theta by getting rid of some other apparently mutually independent hypotheses, and it will extend the coverage. So again, he traces the consequences of this change, this addition, until he tracks it this way to a new observation categorical, which is not in the theory, and that then he tests. I don't know an example of this, but there probably are some. Anyways, this kind of thing one dreams of, dreaming of the improvement of the theory, just by getting a more elegant, stronger theory, without ever having the process to give anything up. A third way begins with the chance observation. Chance observation is contrary to an observation categorical, which he supposed was true. From there on, the scientist proceeds in the first way. He excises that observation categorical that by this chance observation turned out to be to his surprise, not to hold. This time it wasn't because of the experiment. It was just, he's just happened to see a black swan, and somehow by his standard it was a swan, right? He excises that categorical and some of the sentences which fit together apply it, and seeks a new hypothesis and presses it for consequent observation categoricals as usual. A fourth way, theory might change. Just the chance observation of something surprising, this time not violating a preconceived observation categorical, says something that he hadn't expected. He casts around for an explanation, as we'd say. He casts around at least for generalization, an observation categorical of which this would be a case. He tries generalizing this one pair of observations, this thing with that, then proceeds as before, perhaps without exciting anything. Now, as we know, it was a lot of vagueness of observation sentences, as in the case of this one example. Or another case, something more typical, take the salt dissolves in water. Salt dissolves in water. This, prima facie, this is a typical observation categorical. Typically, for most of us, salt is an observation sentence, an observation term, an observation sentence to begin with. Tasting it is a pretty immediate way of checking. Dissolution, just put it in water, watch, observation. Observable. Salt dissolves in water is an observation category. It's a focal observation category, like one, didn't we? Well, so now I'm just leave it more explicitly if we're going to very technical about it. Sodium chloride dissolves in H2O, dissolves in hydrogen oxide. But not just suppose there were an isotope, not NaCl, but NaCl star, that looks like ordinary salt and even tastes like it, because it's soluble in saliva, as ordinary salt is, but it's not soluble in water, not in pure H2O. Then, if there is such a thing, if you find such a one, then NaCl itself, sodium chloride, ceases to be an oxidation sentence. It's going to take some recondite testing to distinguish between the NaCl and its isotope. NaCl dissolves in H2O, ceases to be an oxidation categorical, it's demoted or elevated, however you look at it, to the status of of theoretical chemistry. It turns out, actually, according to what I've been supposing here, to be false. Starting with that same example, it's all dissolved in water, but forgetting now about that fictitious isotope. The same example, salt dissolved in water, NaCl dissolves in H2O, I can still get a Bloom's treatment of another kind in science. I mean, this is characteristic. Maybe it's not strictly true. It's an observation categorical again at this point, since we're abandoning the primitive hypothesis about the isotope. But maybe it's not strictly true. Maybe it's some extreme of temperature or some extreme of pressure that it doesn't hold. NaCl dissolves in H2O, other things being ordinarily it does. This means that, and so what's the science going to do in practice using this? I think typically what will happen is that, yes, he'll appeal to it as if it were true. And then they want to have other things explicitly or tacitly that comes into his reasoning when he's going from some more serious hypothesis to some experimental setup, some observation categorical. He'll bring this into healthy argument. But then it might happen if the tests of whatever he's testing turn out negative, but the hypothesis that he's testing is really something that he'd rather went into anyhow, because if it were true, it would go on and went out with some further interesting things. Is it some other way he could account for the failure of this experiment? And then he'll go back and maybe this very thing about salt dissolving in water. And he'll look at that twice. Well, other things we need put dissolving in water, but maybe there are exceptional circumstances here that would prevent it from dissolving in water. And so then he starts looking into this Ketteri's parables and finds out that other things weren't people in the way that he had supposed. So here he's giving up one of the auxiliary hypotheses. Well, very good. But he's not going to give it up, in fact. It's going to go right back to the old other things being equal status. And it'll be used again by the next time round. He was given some other thing in other situations where it can be fully expected that salt will be in water. And I think this surely is typical of a lot of scientific procedure. And I'm not objecting to it. I mean, the science says that when it wants to get on to more interesting things. But this is an example of how the caricature that I'm drawing of the nature of testing of hypotheses is an idealization, and how there's apt to be more complexity, not only in the matter of vagueness in this case, but in principle, in completeness of conditions. This sutra and policy is sometimes made explicit, but vague usually. Sometimes it's made quantitative, roughly, by probability, actually numerical probability. It's called for when there aren't sufficiently detailed causal accounts, as in meteorology, for instance, economics, epidemiology, something like mass, I should say, critical mass, critical semantic mass. Well, now that approach, where I'm talking about empirical content, has to be distinguished from what I just suggested here, which is a sort of, again, a caricature, but somewhat more realistic, of what the scientist can be imagined actually doing as he finds experimental implications of his theory. What he's actually doing without ever writing a logical symbol. But that approach isn't the one suited to talking about empirical content, because here, what distinguishes the approach regarding empirical content is, and what makes it pertinent, is comparison of theories, two theories being empirically equivalent, having the same empirical content. And so here we want to get outside both theories. It doesn't mean getting outside any other theory. We can't, according to a naturalistic point of view anyway. But these theories can be fender-limited. Getting outside both of them, and we're applying our own self-conscious explicit logic to these theories. Whether the theorists in question in either theory happen to notice the, all the logical implications or not. So here we stay with the theory theta rather than letting the theorist more or less happen to be extended to theory prime theory, theta prime theta in a second. We stay with theta. And consider what categorical it implies outright, known or unknown to the science who proposes the theory. The logic we use, well, we can think of it as being perhaps classical predicate logic plus identity. People who talk about theories commonly think of them, commonly intend them as deductively closed. That is, theory is not just any set of sentences, but it's those sentences together with all the sentences that they might be implied. Theory, what I'm doing, we don't want to take theory in that sense as logically closed. Rather, it's just any set of sentences, any set of cognitive sentences which would have true features. Because then there's a question of a separate operation. The thing is, I want to bring the logic out in the open. Bring it out in the open in one way in this progressive modus ponens procedure that I sketched. And another way when we're comparing two theories by our own logic, not imputing any awareness of these, full awareness, full command of logic to either. The implied observation categoricals as the checkpoints of theories. This sustains Karl Popper's, Sir Charles, falsificationist stance. Well, and I'm sure it's very generally, very widely shared. Namely, what is conclusive, if anything, is an unfavorable check of the theory. Refutation of the theory by an unfavorable check. That, if anything, is conclusive. In fact, with the whole scientific method, however, science would waste away. Theories would endure until they got a negative check, and then they'd get whittled down by exclusion of enough to dismantle, the, to defuse the conflict. And so it would be a matter of either status integration or ever dwindling theory. The rest of the activity is maintenance of theory and advancement of theory. Checking is the negative side of maintenance. Subsequent repairs, the positive side. Further advancement, well, a couple of these, the second and fourth in various ways, five, the word that I enumerated, in which energy might be infused into a theory to make it seethe. These were cases of advancement of the theory. One of them was the bright idea from simply studying the structure of the theory, simplification and or extension of the theory by generalization, without any retraction. Another was invention of a hypothesis to explain a chance observation, again, nothing being thrown away but something being added. This is not in disagreement with Karl Popper, because these are not cases of establishing proof. These are cases of thinking up new hypotheses that might be true. It doesn't prove them. But thinking up new things that are worth testing, worth checking. And the check, again, is going to be negative. That is, if it changes anything, it changes it downward. So, devising hypotheses, there's the constructive end of it. Whether as repairs or as pure advances, this is where creativity enters. A vague and committed heuristic is simplicity. I haven't got any good criterion for simplicity. Nelson Cook worked on that many years ago. In certain limited domains, in a way that certain restrictions, reasonable standards for comparable simplicity, but in general, I don't know any good one. But generally, in practice, we can judge this theory is simpler than that by our lights. And it's pretty much an open question why, other things being equal, the simplicity of the simpler of two combinations of existing data is the likelier to be true. There seems to be no contesting the wisdom of this as a heuristic, even though it may be quite a puzzle why it should be true at all. I have five thoughts that I find amusing in that direction, but none of them gets to the heart of the matter. One of them, we perceive the simple, and we miss the complex. So most of our progress is with the simple issue. Very simple-minded one. An example here I think of in typesetting. Some of you have noticed it in books. Others of you are likely have noticed it in the proofreading. Sometimes, just by chance, the spacing between words in one line, another line, another line, will line up somewhat. So if you get something like a white stream down the page, and it's remarkable how it stands out, you see that. More zigzagging a path that you might make between a space in one line, between words, a space between words in the next line, it doesn't stand out at all. A good printer breaks those rivers, as it were, and by just resetting the lines a little bit, so not to have that bothersome phenomenon. It's the simplicity of the city that makes the thing visible. And the thing isn't that simple, you just don't see it. You don't see it. Just look at successions of spaces. You can't miss the river. It's because it's geometrically simpler. It's more nearly linear. Second, a question may admit only of a simple answer. This sometimes happens. or none. That's to say, if you may have a question, we make tests to see whether it's true or not. One of two things may happen. The test may show yes, it's true. Well, this again is the counter proper, but to show it's true, granted, other things that we're prepared to believe. Or it may not show anything, but it will never show that it's false. There are questions that can be put that way. One of them is this, having to do again with the innate similarity space, the perceptual similarity. Question regarding the innate similarity space, which has to precede the first learning of anything, since all learning depends on this. On some perceptual similarity. Question: do dogs have identical similarity spaces? Innate ones. I mean, are there innate perceptual spaces alike? Well, find this out. We test two dogs by that method of reinforcement and distinction of responses, and we plot their. We catch them early. We want to get the innate space as early as we can. We map these spaces and compare the maps. The maps turn out very much alike, suppose. We can draw two conclusions. One, that we still caught the innate spaces. Because if the dogs have had experience for any appreciable time, surely their experience would be different enough so that their spaces would be corrupted or be changed enough from the innate. But here they're both alike. We're always barring very implausible coincidences. These were the innate spaces. And furthermore, second conclusion, the innate perceptual spaces of dogs are alike. Rich, two conclusions. If they don't come out, these maps don't come out much alike, then we have to draw either conclusion. The most we can conclude is the negation of the conjunction. We could conclude reasonably that it's not the case both that we caught innate spaces in the part of both dogs and that they were different. So there's a case where the cards are stacked to begin with in favor of one conclusion and not the other, the simpler conclusion. A third consideration about simplicity has to do with round numbers. If the first reading of measurement of some kind, a pointer reading. The first reading is 5.24, and the second one is more careful reading, more accurate measurement is 5.22. The second one is a correction of the first. If, on the other hand, the first reading is merely 5.2, and the second one is 5.22, we regard the second reading as a confirmation of the first. It's just getting out now to a further decimal place. This, of course, is well known and is combative, and scientists speak of carrying things out to the less significant decimal place. Before they did that, or if they someone weren't aware of that, here's a case where unconsciously simplicity comes in. Because the matter of 5 2/10 is a simpler number, some intuitive sense of simplicity, than 5.24 hundredths. This same phenomenon, when it's not a matter of decimal places, does go unchallenged, perhaps, in graphs in various parts of science, especially more churchyard parts of science. If you have quite a smooth curve, a simple curve, and you're plotting points, and this curve is supposed to be a curve through the points, and you've got a point that's a little bit off that curve, just a little bit, that's fine. Either theory is being confirmed by such points. But if it was a complicated curve and the point were just that far from it, you'd regard it as a correction. So here again, the courage is stacked. We're sustaining simplicity by applying the simplicity maxim. We're applying the maxim of the simpler is the more likely to be true, and opposing it. A fourth possibility. Simplicity is linked to perceptual similarity. And certainly that is the case, at least for a good deal of what we count as simplicity, perceptual similarity. Take the deck of cards. Five cards at random. Two diamonds, a heart, two clubs. Is more complicated than five hearts. Somehow. The five hearts are similar to one another. The clubs, diamonds, spades, are not. But there's a connection between simplicity and similarity. And then, as far as this present, our present question is concerned, the corollary would be that perceptual simplicity, we know, is rigged by natural selection. We satisfy ourselves with that. There's survival value in having a similarity space that matches nature to that point very well. So insofar then as simplicity is tied to similarity, that would suggest that there is an element of natural selection in our simplicity standards, which does make them. And here would be a case where, in some mild and small degree anyway, it is actually true, effectively, that simplicity by our makes is somewhat in favor of the truth of a hypothesis. Well, and then five, there's less to go wrong. Short scenario, a simple one, and then a complicated one. Not so much more simplicity. I think there's more to be thought up there, more to be understood. It's been objected to naturalized epistemology that it has no normative side. But I say it does have a normative side, and I say that these things that we're considering just now are there, along with other things. And I say that natural science has a normative side. But I say that the normative side of natural science is engineering. And engineering tells us, advises us, natural science in engineering, advises us on making good things, making good bridges, bridges that don't fall in. There's good and there's bad. It's normative. Normative natural science is technology. And what in particular about normative naturalized epistemology? I say it's technology of the framing of hypotheses, the technology of framing of hypotheses that are going to be good ones in the sense that they're going to stand up under some test. In short, it's the technology of prediction, because the test is always a test of a prediction. And simplicity maxims or the maxim of simplicity, is an example of such a normative maxim. Another one is the maxim of minimum mutilation, as I called it. But you do have to change the theory. Other things being equal, the less of a change, the better. I speculated just now five bits of speculation on why the maximum simplicity is a good one. As for why the maximum minimum mutilation is a good one, in other words, the maximum conservatism, But the conservative change, the theory can not change too much, inherits from past successes the observational evidence that supported the past theories, which we should receive, insofar as stay close to the old theories. Another reason in favor of the maxim is that the less we change, the less demand there is on creative imagination. Not only the more likely it is that we're going to think of that change in the first place, but also the more utility in our old habits, when we go on thinking in the terms of new theory, the more our old habits will save us instead of getting in the way of our creative thinking. Also, it minimizes backtracking. So these are technological reasons for these technological maxims, which it seems to me are what normative is when epistemology is naturalized. When these two maxims, simplicity and conservatism, collide, and of course they can collide, then I think what we do, and I say what we should do, although this might be hard to justify, what we should do, and this again is clearly normative, let the simple prevail over the conservative. And this is what happened with Einstein over what had happened to, well, Einstein's theory is not as simple as Newton's, right? But then you fix Newton's up with what you have to add in the way of accommodating further discoveries, things like Lorentz transformation and Fitzgerald contraction and whatever. You get a much simpler theory by switching to Einstein's relativity. But it's a branch, and we give up our whole notion of absolute time and absolute spatial distances in favor of a mixture of two which changes with the speed of the observer. And we happen to and of course we happen to do so. But even here, there's conservatism as far as we can reconcile it. The successes of the primordial Newtonian physics still lend their support, insofar as they were supported by past experience, to Einstein's theory when the speed is not excessive and when the distance is not excessive. So in a way, one theory is a generalization of the other. This brings to a third maxim, seek generality. Mainly a case of simplicity again. Maybe one theory serve in place of several. But also generality opens more scope for refutation, which is an advantage because that enables you to make decisive tests and get away from your mistakes that much more quickly. Stronger the case for the theory in those circumstances when it does stand up against the effort at refutation. And finally, the fourth overarching maxim, as I urged the other day, is empiricism itself. At the point of normative epistemology, in the technology of prediction, it counsels us to be aware of soothsayers, of telepathy, claims of revelation, clairvoyance. Characteristically of naturalized epistemology, it rests on findings of natural science, as I urged it today. Other matters likewise fall under normative naturalized epistemology, in other words, technology of prediction, namely more sophisticated matters, techniques of statistics, where I talk about significant correlation, margins of error, techniques of formal logic also could fail when you're trying to trace out the implications of a theory. Or when we study a theory for possible simplification, possible extension. Well, that might be a place to start with the discussion.
Oh, yes, sir. One point you mentioned. actually often, because very useful to give a definition of theory, and one that is often found is if you use your system to collect the idea of something that is fully axiomatized, or some system where you have closure and conjunction. But you have felt a place which is effective, and what we suggested today, because today seven sentences could be divided as a theory. That seems to be too liberal. But I just take not to note that any set of sentences which are interconnected in such a way that evidence is transferred between the sentences to be called a theory. But the transference would have to be through deduction, to be much more open than that. Because you certainly would not have called a theory. I call all the entities in the concept of pizza. I can get on points that they're not.
This becomes a question of the degree to which we want to sustain and explicate ordinary usage. And that's for yes, because of a random collection of sentences is certainly not an actual application of the term of theory. On the other hand, I think my tendency in other contexts often as well. Rather is to take a simple concept and not care about the unnatural cases that fall under it, as long as they're not going to falsify the thing we want to do. And in the case of these, say a cluster of sentences that have no lexicon in common, they have nothing in common except ordinary logical particles and the like, grammatical particles. So that there are not going to be any interesting logical implication from any of them. Well, all right, but they don't imply any observation of any article, and they don't have a critical semantic mass, and also a lot of collection of sentences which are relevant to one another also don't have critical semantic mass, and some do. If they do happen to have critical semantic mass, they will then necessarily have been sentences that were fairly relevant to one another. So these extremely inappropriate cases are imagined simply not. So I think this is one of those cases where it's well secured between ordinary language and something more in the spirit of a notation for a given purpose. Or is there another problem?
Yes, you know, you could have a group of sentences that are critical semantic mass, and that I think you almost see very often. But then you, according to this liberal definition we gave today, you can just throw in with it any arbitrary mixture of other sentences completely unrelated. Sure. You still call it theory. That seems like a
It's a little odd in terms of what we ordinarily think of as a theory, what's the alternative? The alternative is to set up a rather more complicated definition that would be more suitable to the dictionary. It would be complicated, and the person would get us.
Well, I thought the one that you gave, that footnote, which of course I can't recall where you had, was that a good one, because you have a set of sentences, but all the sentences are interconnected in such a way that evidence, that's the phrase you use, evidence is transferred between the sentences.
Such a way of evidence,
but evidence is transferred between the sentences. That is, every sentence in the set is connected in some other sentences in the set through evidence transferred, evidence relations. So that the evidence that goes against one sentence in the set will also go against some of the others. And you don't have to specify exactly how the evidence is transferred. It need not be as straight as through deduction, but still, that would not be completely unrelated to one
another. Well, I think that there's one practical moral I might draw based on your suggestion, and I admit, I think perhaps it's a good one. Namely, to drop the word theory. If I couldn't, I just as well say set of sentences, sometimes I do. Is it, I've heard, is that what you mean?
What I was trying to connect with, what's connected with this is that I think we should repeat where we do that differently now from how you talk in theory of things in pursuit of truth. You see, you were suggesting here, if you're a failure, they're fine, they're fine. There was some difference between what you said there. You just said it when you asked about it. So why don't you repeat that? And what is the advantage of what you're doing now in the way you describe the same process with observation categoricals in theory of things?
Yes, the advantage of doing it with that theory of things prime and so on is a closer, more realistic caricature of the procedure of ordinary thinking in science and others. And the difference is, the difference between this and what was in pursuit of truth is that what was in pursuit of truth is the thing I did second, to describe second when I was going into empirical content. Namely, there, I'm talking about what's implied by a given set of sentences, actually implied by it, according to us and our and genuine logic, whether anybody finds out that they are blind or not. So these are two different things, two different topics. And the second, which is the earlier one, I mean, it's the one in pursuit of truth, but what I get second here is the one relevant to the notion of empirical time.
Right.
The first is the one that fits in with the general discussion of what in its main essential lines is going on in science.
And then, and then the way of describing it now is best not to call what's going on in science and theory. Right. That's the point.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, there's another reason also why how much weight this should carry, but I think that certainly in terms of motivation is a reason. I like, as far as possible, treating logical truths, mathematical truths, truths of natural science on an equal basis. When the thing is set up the way where we're using our segregated logical machine and applying it to this and that set of sentences to find out empirical content. We're giving logic a separate status from the rest. We can think of it as a matter of our choice, how much we put into that logic, whether just what I suggested, that is predicate logic and identity. Or whether we want to take in some or all of mathematics and maybe even, although logic is a funny word for it anymore, a lot of ordinary common sense platitudes of a non-logical kind. Wherever we do that, we're drawing a boundary, and I would say as far as actual science, either science as pursued or science as it should be pursued, is artificial, is arbitrary, and